And just stepped into the room. I think we've just begun recording. So we don't have any really official rules on who the chair of this committee is, but I would guess we would turn it over to the mayor to do a welcome and introduction.
Well, welcome to the audit committee meeting for December 3rd, 2024. My first item is approval of the audit committee meeting minutes of September 17th.
I'll make the motion to approve the audit committee minutes of September 17th, 2024.
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Next item is an update on the 2024 audit. Corey, Charles, we'll turn over to you.
Yeah, thank you guys for giving me some time to come in and touch base with you all. When I had talked with Heidi about coming in and speaking with you all, we wanted to kind of not only present a bit of an update on where the 2024 audit is, but also to give information regarding how the process of the audit works to provide you with some more information. In the audit process, we generally begin by obtaining financial information from a variety of different sources. Obviously, that would include financials prepared by the city, in this case by Heidi, and using that for year-to-year comparisons, for certain ratios, to identify certain areas of interest within the audit. We also review the minutes of the city to look for any significant events during the year that we would want to identify and look at in more detail. We will inquire of management, relevant staff who are involved in the financial reporting process. So a lot of the finance department, as well as certain court clerks as well, and those charged with governance. You know, that fun little email we always have to send out to you every year asking if you're aware of any fraud or instances like that. We obtain an understanding of internal control relevant to the audit so that we may design audit procedures that are appropriate. Though we don't obtain this understanding to issue an opinion similar to how we would issue an opinion on whether the financial statements are free, we're providing reasonable assurance on the financial statements. We'll also identify risks that are relevant to the current position of the city and annual activities of the city. Now, when we say risk, generally the stigma that comes along with it is that risks are bad. Risks are neither good nor bad inherently. You know, they just kind of are. For example, one risk that we identified with the 2024 audit was that golf course revenues increased by about 25% or more in a lot of its major revenue lines. So that's a good thing, you know, the golf course makes more money, but it's something that we want to take a closer look at as part of the audit. This is a section of the audit report that we issue. This was taken from the 2023 financial statements. Just to give a better idea of the auditor's responsibilities, there will be this section subtitled Auditor's Responsibilities for the Audit of the Financial Statements. And these bullet points are a good breakdown of what we do during the audit. You know, we exercise professional judgment and maintain professional skepticism throughout the audit. When we are discussing certain things with Heidi, you know, she may tell us the reason why something exists, and it could be reasonable, but you want to validate that with external evidence, right? And that's not because we don't believe Heidi, it's we just need to be able to verify that with other documentation as well. And so that's what professional skepticism would be. We identify and assess risks of material misstatement, as I mentioned before, obtain an understanding of internal control, as I mentioned before. We also evaluate the appropriateness of accounting policies used. So this has not been something that we've ran into with the city, to my knowledge, but if depreciation looked like it was being accelerated a bit too fast, for example, or if there were certain policies regarding accounts receivable that would stray a bit from generally accepted accounting principles, we would evaluate whether these were appropriate. And this final one is one that it always exists, conclude whether in our judgment there are conditions or events that raise substantial doubt about the city's ability to continue as a going concern. This is essentially evaluating whether there is a risk that the city won't be in operations in a year from the day the law report. Obviously that hasn't been something that's come up with the city before, but just like with professional skepticism, just like our emails to you inquiring about fraud, it's something that is a standard part of the audit procedures. The scope of our test work during the audit also is dependent on the circumstances and risks that are related to the audit. For example, when we review subsequently issued checks for expenses that are potentially not on the unpaid invoice report that should be, the amount of subsequently issued checks that we had to review this year, just due to the amounts of those checks, was a lot larger than this year compared to the years prior. And that's just, you know, the ebbs and flows of the times. There wasn't any specific reason. It was just the scope of the test work had to be a little bit expanded this year compared to the year prior. And going back to the risk I mentioned with the golf revenues increasing a lot in fiscal year 24, if they stayed pretty consistent with the amounts that were of annual revenues of fiscal 24 into fiscal year 25, then we would probably be able to reduce the scope of our test work because it's more constant, it's more consistent with the prior year revenues. Other test work that we do as part of the audit includes state compliance. State compliance is issued by the state auditor's office and is broken up primarily into two different chapters, as they're called. Chapter 1 is an annual review of certain items that are tested every single year. Things like budgetary compliance, justice court items, fund balance items. Things that you would want information on every single year. There's also Chapter 2 items, which are rotated through testing every 3 years. This includes things like the Cash and Money Management Act, things like impact fees, those kinds of items. And another item that I just wanted to bring to your attention in terms of the audit process is we rely a lot on third-party confirmations. And this goes back to the professional skepticism responsibility I mentioned before, where we will obtain tax confirmations from the county, as well as pension information from URS and the actuaries with their actuary reports directly from them in order to corroborate the amounts reported by the city. And as I mentioned with professional skepticism, it's not because we don't believe what's being reported. It's that this provides us with the level of assurance that we're engaged to provide and report on as auditors. In terms of the progress or position of the fiscal year 2024 audit, we are nearly complete. Our internal review items are nearly finished, and we've discussed the appropriate journal entries with Heidi. A lot of them were ones that she had already made subsequent to the end of the year as part of the closing procedures. There were just a couple that were provided or will be provided once our internal review is concluded. And then when those journal entries are provided, the financial statements will be able to be prepared and they'll be presented to us, the auditors, first, so that we can review them, add our audit report or auditor reports, the overall audit opinion, reports on state compliance, on internal control as required, and then they will be given back to the city. And that is essentially how the audit concludes. Once the financial statements are completed, we obtain a representation letter from management and agreements on the journal entries that we provided. Then generally that's the point at which we come in, we present to this council regarding the audit, regarding the financial statements. That's generally how the process has gone. I know that was a lot of me talking. I guess, does anyone have any questions about the audit process, about what we do as part of the audit, anything like that?
When you talked about a couple of small items, will they be identified now as findings?
Just having the journal entries wouldn't identify them as findings. There were a couple items that we had identified that would not constitute an inclusion in a schedule of findings and would only be included in the communication with governance letter that we send out with the financial statements. It is not a part of the financial statements, this communication with governance letter, but it is a part of the audit process that we would send out. The items that came up as findings for the year, the first was a interfund transfer from the RDA fund to the general fund exceeded the budgeted amount by $3,542. And the second item that we had as a finding was during the year, I cannot remember the department name. Heidi, do you know what department Cameron is with?
Oh, he's in buildings.
Buildings. So, and this was something I believe was at the last city council meeting, this resolution of reactivation fees for building permits. During the fiscal year 2024, the reactivation fees were authorized to be collected, so the $100 reactivation fee, but it was not an approved fee as part of the fee schedule. Obviously, that has since been resolved with the resolution that was passed at the last council meeting, but it was able to be collected, or it was at times collected during fiscal year 2024.
So I have, Corey, I want to say up front, I respect the work that you do. The audit is really important, and I've been on the council for quite some time and don't always understand what the audit is telling me. And what I do want to ask is two things. Have you, in your experience with cities and doing audits of cities, had instances where there have been raised substantial doubts about cities? Have you seen that?
I have not myself. I am aware of some situations where doubt has been raised regarding governmental entities, but I don't have experience with a governmental entity, city or otherwise, that has experienced that doubt.
And the reason that I raise that is I think I may be lulled into a false sense of security because we don't see it, right? And your job is to make sure you have that healthy skepticism, so we rely on you. It's been known to happen in other places, but I mean, I would gather that it is something that is predictable, right? In other words, maybe this year it's not a substantial doubt, but it's significant. Or we've got some serious risks that we have to address, but you see it coming, if that were the case, and it hadn't been remedied on a fiscal year basis. Is that correct?
Yeah, so substantial doubt doesn't... The way that I had worded it, of substantial doubt to continue existence throughout the next year, that is substantial doubt with a going concern. However, if there was a situation where there are constant recurring losses, right, where let's say the revenues being collected by the city were on a consistent year over year over year basis, not the revenues were being exceeded by the
sure.
expenditures. And say the city was just spending beyond its means. That would be something where we would be able to see a trend, and it may be something that we would raise with management, or depending on the severity of it, those charged with governance, the audit committee and the city council. And generally in terms of reporting, because a going concern is something that would need to be reported in the audit report as well. Generally, in terms of being included in the audit report, is when it gets to that year basis of significant doubt about being able to continue operations for the next year. But if there were, as you mentioned, there was a sense of security where there potentially should be some cause for concern, that would be something we would address with management or those charged with governance, depending on the severity of the decline that would be happening.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned some stakeholder meetings that you have to handle, you know, like the money market net or money market. And also the, I have a question on procurement. Do you guys analyze anything about how procurements are handled when you do audits?
About procurements?
You know, how RFPs are awarded or anything like that. Do you ever look into that? Not that we have problems. Just curious, because I know that there are other code sections that you addressed, but you didn't mention procurement.
Off the top of my head, I think with procurements, the only items I've ever had to test regarding that, obviously if there's expenditures that are large enough to warrant a bid process, and it's a large and constant ongoing process, then we would potentially look into those. Maybe not as part of state compliance specifically, but as we are evaluating different expenditures that happen during the year, we are looking for those approvals the proper approvals to be in place. For example, supervisors handling expenditures up to 500, department heads up to 5,000, city manager up to 25, and beyond that, the different bidding processes that exist. I'm not aware of anything state compliance-wise over procurement off the top of my head. I have dealt when it comes to single audits. Obviously, that wasn't the case for fiscal year 24. For single audits, if particularly of ARPA funds, there were some rules in place regarding the procurement of certain materials for projects. This didn't apply to North Salt Lake's ARPA fund usage, as it was the replacement of lost wages or paying for essential staff. So in terms of the testing procurements, it depends on the scope of the test work. There were no items that we felt necessary to test the procurement process in terms of bids and those items. But as we did expense testing, where we were looking at invoices and purchase orders for different expenditure accounts throughout the city's different funds, that was an item that we included in our test work, was ensuring that there was a proper level of supervision or the appropriate level of approval that was occurring.
Corey, how many records would you say were tested for expenditure control?
In terms of like different invoices and purchase orders, or mm-hmm. in terms of different accounts?
I would say in terms of individual purchase records, so the invoices.
Yeah.
So when in our testing for specifically expenditures that were not tested elsewhere, so for example, wages, right, are an expenditure mm-hmm. that we test as a part of our payroll processes. The checks and the invoices that relate to those checks subsequent to year end that we review are a part of the accounts payable process that we do. In terms of expenditure testing that we did not test anywhere else, we selected a sample of 60 invoices and purchase orders to test for that expense testing, and we also tested a month's worth of credit card statements, the March 2024 credit card statements,
okay.
All of those credit cards.
Great, thank you. It's getting noisy here. It's closing time.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Corey.
Did you have some samples to show? I know we talked about the RDA. You and I had discussed some other items that will be in that letter to governance.
Yeah, with those, because we had talked about the credit card statement.
Uh-huh.
And before we make a final decision on those, I'd like to double check the credit card statement.
Okay.
On that one.
Was it May or March?
I believe it was May.
Okay, that's what you...
March was the credit card statements that we came in and tested independently.
Okay.
The May one was what we did as part of our initial, like, walkthroughs of controls.
Okay. So the May, maybe could you explain what we're talking about a little bit? The approvals authorization?
Yeah, so in our obtaining an understanding of internal controls, what we do as part of that process is we have Heidi or the relevant staffers kind of walk us through the entire procedure first on kind of a verbal basis as we document it and turn it into kind of a process. And then we will select items at random as part of that process. So for instance, credit cards. We chose a certain employee's credit card statements for the month of May. And what we do is we identify the key controls that were described to us in the process by the staff. And we review it for that randomly selected item to ensure that the controls are in place. And if the controls are not working, then they would be rolled as a into our risk. And by rolled, I just mean that they would be accrued as a risk in some way or fashion to the rest of the risks. An item that we had noted during our walkthroughs for the credit card statements was that on those invoices for the credit card statement, there was some invoices that, or some purchase orders that did not have a proper signature. But further along in the process, the invoice approval report had passed by Heidi and went through that level of approval before they were paid. So our concern was not necessarily that certain items were not being looked at or reviewed in the overall process, but that there were maybe a couple invoices missed by department heads or supervisors or the relevant signer for those items. And that said, I wanted to double check the statement for that before making a final determination on the level of issuance. Depending on the statement, it may just be a verbal issuance where it's technically what we would consider a finding. However, the level of it is either mitigated sufficiently enough or it's insignificant enough in the overall financial reporting process that we deem a verbal issuance correction sufficient in the first year that we notice it. Obviously, if it was a repeat item that we would notice, then there would be an increased level of reporting of it. But this is something that we didn't notice, you know, last year or fiscal year 22. The years that I've been working with IDB, I haven't noticed anything before this one instance. So I want to double check the statement one more time before making a determination on if it needs to be included in the communication with governance letter or if items have been mitigated sufficiently enough to leave it at a verbal.
So if you take a look at the year, so in Our monthly financial statements, we get funds into the three different project areas once a year in April. And a portion of those goes towards an administration fee. I think Corey's going to pull that pull something up. The amount of the, we're required to put 5% as that transfer from that project area increment that the RDA receives. The amount, because we receive more revenue, that 5% transfer was a higher dollar amount than what was budgeted. And it exceeded in aggregate. I think the total amount of the transfer was maybe $80,000. So we were over by about $3,500.
Because you were following the 5%.
Because we were following the 5% of the total revenue received to go back to the general fund.
Mm-hmm. A correction might have been a budget amendment.
We could have, and probably would have normally been picked up in a budget amendment.
Yeah.
I want to say that I noticed that, but I'm always looking to make sure that when I compile all of the RDAs together, that we're not going to go over budget as the project as a whole.
Yeah.
And we were still in compliance there. I hadn't noticed that the transfer itself was off.
Yeah, as Heidi mentioned, this was just a work paper that we had used to provide a estimate or a comparison. These numbers here, these are the account numbers relevant to the transfer title listed here. These are the amounts of the transfer for each title. Obviously, some transfers were not, they didn't exist, you know, general fund transfers to the golf fund, there were none, obviously. But we compared the numbers from the financials to the budgeted amounts. All of these budgeted amounts came from the final amended budget. And here you can see there were three instances where there was a no. The amount transferred exceeded the budgeted amount. What we did was we aggregated those transfers. So here you can see this one was $651 over budget. However, the transfer to the housing fund from another one of the individual RDAs was under budget by a significant amount. So when we netted them together, the total transfer from the RDA fund as a whole to the housing fund was still under budget. So we passed on it. The transfer to the general fund, though, from the funds 20, 21, and 22, the Eaglewood, Redwood, and Highway 89 funds, aggregated that $3,500 difference. And so that was where the discrepancy came from. And these findings as a where these findings are only being included in the communication with governance or potentially as verbal recommendations, these are not ones that would inherently impair our ability to issue an unmodified opinion or the higher level of audit opinion that we can issue with our audit report. These ones, the fact that they're being included with the communication with governance instead of as a schedule of findings is indicative that the amount is either inconsequential or the level of non-compliance is inconsequential. In this one, obviously, it's a case of, you know, it's $3,500. It's out of compliance, sure, but it is, you know, when you're talking about millions of dollars of transfers, right? $3,500 is frankly an inconsequential amount.
Anything else, Ben?
Not sure, but there are other items, Corey?
None that come to my mind. I hope this has been helpful in terms of understanding the audit process, how we go about things. I'm sure, Heidi, as I was finishing up our internal review today and sending Heidi email after email as I needed certain reports, I'm sure I was annoying her, but, you know, we want to make sure that the documentation and the audit opinion that we're providing is of a high quality, but also that you're understanding what we do with the audit, right? A brain surgeon could, you know, tell you all the ins and outs of how they do what they do, but sometimes you just want to make sure that, you know, the surgery went well, right? But with audits, we want to make sure, obviously, that you have that better understanding of how stuff went instead of just, you know, finances are fine. You know, that's a good outcome, but how did we get there? What did we look at, you know?
Great. Well, thank you, Corey.
Thank you.
Absolutely. If you guys do have any other questions, you can feel free to let Heidi know. She'll communicate them to me, and I'm more than happy to clarify or expound on different items. But with that, I will leave the meeting. But like I said, if any questions, communicate.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Thank you, Corey.
So, do you mind if I just clarify something that maybe might be helpful? Just, I was thinking as we were talking about accounts payable, you may or may not know, you talked about different signers on the purchase order. And so all of our purchase orders have to be signed by someone who's able to sign and responsible for the payment. And then above certain amounts requires my signature, or the department's signature. But I wanted to clarify that before we do a weekly check-in, usually, a payment schedule, that before that gets done, it gets reviewed by Heidi. So even though those individual purchase orders have been reviewed and signed, Heidi looks at the entire payment schedule for the week.
So for this finding, he had two individual instances that he gave me. The first one I pulled up, and he told me that this was not authorized, and it was a $462 purchase. And I don't know, because the purchase order is signed by Carmen. So
he's going to look at that one. It may.
And then he had one more that was for Wendy's credit card statement for May of 2024, but I only got that in for a couple hours ago, and I didn't have time to go in the basement and pull it and see. But I would be very surprised if we had an unsigned purchase order, because Alicia wouldn't even schedule it for payment without a signature, and then I'm checking it for signature because I'm checking for signature and dollar. So I would be really surprised if we had one that didn't make it through. And that's why he's saying we're gonna wait till we get your backup on it, because they said they had seen that when they were out looking at our documents, but they missed one. So
what I'm hearing is that there should have been a second signature here.
No,
please.
No, they just missed. They had said this was an instance where we didn't have a signature, and we
did.
But it did.
And
I said, tell me the example of the check. Because I feel pretty confident in our process that I don't even think it would get through Alicia. I've never once seen her send me something without a signature.
Good.
I really am confident.
And especially a credit card. So I'm going to pull that credit card statement, and I don't think that will end up being in the letter, because I'm pretty sure I want documentation support.
And I just thought it might be helpful for you to know what the process is, because we're really, especially when we're making payments, writing checks, we're pretty cautious about
it. I thought it was interesting that you know, for 30 years we lost money handled the fish on the Gulf Coast, and that didn't raise any red flags. And then we make some money.
You just want to make risk can be a good thing.
Make sure you don't want to have mystery money. You never want to have money that you're going to have to pay back at some point.
I think it's the change from the previous year.
Aberrations.
You know,
I would have liked it had a proctology Mark Moses' name up there, you know, 10 years ago. And saw how can we lose it so much.
Yeah.
The other question I could bring up, boards that I'm on go through this process, and they use other firms, and they also question whether they should change audit firms every 3 years or something. So I've always spoken about the Crown.
That would definitely be best practice. And
but yet the continuity, you know, when he said that we hadn't seen this in the past, there is some continuity issues that maybe.
So typically when you transition, you do, the former auditing firm will transfer work papers and share work papers so that they do have some, as much continuity as possible.
What about the amount of time that is spent from start to finish, you know, the four prongs, the interviews and all of that? Start to finish, how long does it take?
It's 6 months.
6 months of continuous work?
Continuous work. Part of the issue is that we keep getting invoices for the prior year, especially during construction season, up through September. Okay. So until we've actually closed out all of the projects for the year, all of the construction that's happening, we can't really begin compiling information and giving paperwork over to test to say, we're done, we've recorded everything that goes in fiscal year 2024 properly, and we've recorded what goes in fiscal year 2025. That's why he was saying his sample was so large, because we had so many subsequent payments, and they have to look at each one of those to make sure that we're recording them in the proper fiscal year, not charging expenses to a prior year. So.
Yeah.
And the amount of money that they charge for the service, have we done an analysis at all to say that's competitive in the industry? Fair market?
I haven't done an analysis, mostly because I'm under the impression that we need to go out to RFP anyway for transparency's purposes. So my expectation would be to help you as an audit committee understand what goes into the audit so that when we're procuring for it, you know what services we're looking for. So I'm hoping we can meet again in January and maybe look at a draft RFP. And see what you think about maybe issuing that. But that's fully my intent, is to have either a different set of firms. I did talk to Orem's finance director, North Davis Sewer's finance director, West Valley City's finance director. They've all gone out to RFP in the last 3 years. They said they only had two or three firms respond. They did not get a very good response, and I'm not sure why that is. Does it mean we won't do it? We will still do it. The one agency ended up going with the same auditing firm again, but asked for a new audit partner that would be independent or unique to them, so that they didn't have, you know, I've worked with Corey now for 3 years, right? You wouldn't want there to need to be developing a relationship, even though I might say to him, I don't think that's right, I've got the backup, that type of thing. But at some point, you know, you're working with auditors and you want to keep that level of separation.
Keep the objectivity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that would be one option that we could do if we get very few responses and somehow our need to stay with Child Richards again for next year, if that's what the audit committee decides.
So the scenario where a city might be at risk, so they're balancing their budget every month, but they must be balancing it by dipping into the general fund continually over and over again.
I'm not super certain what sort of analysis we need, you know, what they would look at.
Yeah, because it seems like to me that if you're balancing your budget every month, you know. And if you're dipping into your general fund every month for years, you know you're in trouble.
I mean, it must be, it must be a review of financial statements.
It is. Do they look at it?
Come from, you know, and it's kind of a gauge of the health. Right.
My thought would be they take a look at those ongoing revenues like sales tax, property tax, especially for general government operations, and make sure that they're coming in sufficiently to fund operating expenditures, and that we're not using one-time revenues to fund ongoing operating expenditures. And they can tell a little bit of that by looking for those nuances and changes in dollar amounts.
I did have a communication in a former city where I was in Saratoga Springs, and One of the comments that related to that was that the city was having over-reliance in their operating revenues on permitting activity. Because we were growing so
growing fast.
So, you know, their recommendation was to strengthen property tax, to strengthen sales tax, to diversify the revenue base, because year over year we were relying too much on development revenue, and if that should stop, which in fact it did in 2007, 2008, it would put the city's operational capabilities at risk. But our city, in my opinion, we have such a diverse revenue, set of revenue streams, and we're certainly not relying on development.
Yeah,
because
no.
That's been dropping.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
all right.
Sales tax.
Let's talk about parameters for you.
Yes. So I did research some other policies. I looked at Salt Lake City's policy. They were actually the only other entity that I could find that does have a hardship policy. I didn't find anything in Ogden.
No.
But I wonder if I go out directly and, I mean, I didn't look specifically.
I was, my old memory, but I think the only one we have is active duty military.
We do, and we've got five homeowners or individuals that are participating in that right now. So Salt Lake City's was interesting, and that's where I got some of the ideas for some of this eligibility criteria. So theirs is 60% and older, 150% of poverty level, or with a disability. So that was kind of their criteria on how they would select.
Disability defined by
so
certain parameters?
Generally, you can file if you have a certain percent disability with the county to get a property tax abatement.
Oh,
and so they're relying on the county property tax.
If they pass that bar, mm-hmm. then
so I would love to start working on our policy, but I wanted to get a better idea of what parameters this group would like to put forth to the city council.
Former elected officials.
Most definitely. I pulled up something in advance because just generalized, I think I have one for everybody.
Yep,
I do. About what you look at, and I think a hardship assistance program must have a demonstration of genuine financial hardship. I don't think it's something that we just simply say, oh, thank you for your service. We're going to, you know what I'm saying? There's got to be a genuine hardship. And when you look at that, proof of it, it will show that you've got, for example, pay stubs, medical bills, mm-hmm. termination notices, and it's got here income level, recent events, so you've got a job loss or major medical expense or a natural disaster. I don't think it should be an ongoing outlay of
so
money.
So you're like a 3 to 6, like a window.
Yeah, but that window idea.
Yeah, the window's good, but I also think that there it has to be demonstrable.
Sure.
And it has to be something that is not that is not systemic with this particular individual.
It's acute rather than
you see what I'm saying?
So
that's where you have
a
job loss,
a one-time
or medical
circumstance.
Expenses or whatever.
So our current policy we should eliminate.
Yeah, I guess it's that we're doing. Yeah. If we're just because
you're
military
service.
Yeah,
we're just
you
saying, hey, we appreciate your sacrifice being away from your family.
Yeah.
We'll throw in your bone. Maybe it's not.
And that's not hardship unless you call hardship military service. If that's demonstrable.
Could be. And
yeah.
Well,
or if they're
you
not.
You could further define it as maybe people have been called up and lost a job.
Exactly.
When
it's
they're
a job
called
loss.
Back into
yes.
military service.
Yes.
So it could be a National Guard person.
That's exactly.
Who has a regular job.
That's a good example.
But now they're.
Yep.
Called overseas.
Yeah.
And then used
yeah.
That's. I don't think that's legal.
To lose your job if
well
you
they,
have
to
do military
service.
Well,
their job has to be put on hold.
Yeah.
They
you,
lose their
yeah. You won't lose your job forever,
but you lose your.
But you stop working.
All right.
But you can see the examples of situations
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
might qualify.
So there would be an application process, and backup, I guess, to be provided and reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have to be completely. Objective, so it had to be very easy for the individual who's reviewing it to know are they eligible or are they not.
Right.
And my thought would be that it shouldn't be staff reviewing this information, and I ran into this problem with the county because I oversaw the tax abatement program while I was there. And it was really challenging because people will be turning in their tax returns, their social security and disability statements, their veteran status statements. I don't think this city wants to collect or be in charge of that information. And so that's where I think having a community partner would be good to help us find or administer the program, at least, and find those folks that are actually eligible.
Yeah, and I saw you had mentioned like a housing authority.
Yeah, the Davis County Housing Authority, the food pantry. We put up a link. So the way, who is it? Gosh, I can't think so.
Maybe through the Community Development Block Grant Program of the county. They
potentially through there. They're doing their housing. They're doing some housing assistance there. It's the Salvation Army that runs it in Salt Lake City. Uh-huh. So it's, the program is Salt Lake City program. But the housing, not the housing authority, the Salvation Army accepts the applications, determines who's eligible, uh-huh, and then passes them on. So that way, it's not the city deciding who gets the benefit.
But that raises one question, devil's advocate here. Who's to say the Salvation Army is objective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why your criteria has to be really set with the documentation. This is what we'll accept for documentation, and they have to meet this criteria.
Yeah.
This percent AMI. This disability is tricky. That's why I don't know that I would want to go that route, but I put it out there because Salt Lake was using it.
Do you know off the top of your head a percentage of delinquency and the percentage of actual shutoffs that we have in our city?
We have very few shutoffs. We're able to collect on almost everything.
And do we have a high percentage of delinquency where there's, it's going into, you know,
living expenses, like your ability to live?
Well, where you're having to harass the person.
No.
We're going to shut off.
Oh.
No, only a handful. When you think of how many accounts we have, it's really only a handful.
So no matter what we come up with, we're anticipating that this isn't going to broaden the net and pull in a lot more. We're anticipating that we're just helping those that are truly in.
My thought would
hardship.
Be, you know, it depends on how we advertise the program and what kind of applications we receive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing if there are folks that are on fixed incomes and are at those poverty levels, they would apply.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have no way of really knowing how many of those anecdotally that we have in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
They're current
mm-hmm.
right now.
They did do a huge income survey, and we know for a fact that the Camelot trailer court
mm-hmm.
is the poorest part.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
those
true.
People live below poverty level.
That's true.
Many of them. It's
they're
really
in. They are located in a qualified census tract, so
yeah.
You could take
so
that
you
type
you
of data.
Could end up with quite a few.
I know. If you deal with the
well,
if we
and
do
is it
time limit,
homeowners
months,
or renters? Because
mm-hmm.
if somebody else owns the property, the way our process and policy works is if bills go unpaid, it rolls to the landlord.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The homeowner.
Right.
So. But that doesn't help those who are renting and maybe have lower income and are renting and having struggles.
But that's
struggles.
Where your housing authorities come in. That's where your HUD comes in. There's a lot of other programs to address that. This
mm-hmm.
is for a hardship that is acute. That's the difference.
It has to be tied to an event.
Yes.
Right. Okay. A triggering.
Because if we look at Camelot as a whole, that's more of a systemic problem. It's not an acute problem. And so issuing a 3-month utility pass, I mean, that's just a teeny little band-aid.
And then the other thing about it is that then they want to have a renewal because
right.
the situation will not change.
That's what happened. So, okay, when can I apply again? 12 months? That's
exactly.
why I put that in here. Okay, if we are going to let people do it and
yeah.
it's going to be a limited time, is it a one-time only
yeah, I
benefit
mean it, and the other
for
thing
each
is if the person
resident?
Is denied, then they're going to want to appeal. So then you're going to have that piece of it.
Yep. And that's why I feel like that administered by an outside entity, the city council would be kind of act as the appeal authority for applications that are refused and denied.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I envision it.
And
the
I don't know how the disability, the domestic violence piece, because that can be chronic, that can be acute.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly how that would fit in, but.
Do you have an idea of how long you'd want the program, to how much, how many months of benefit, and what percentage? That could give me something to start on as far as...
When you want, percentage of what?
What percentage of the bill will be discounted? 100%, 50%? How much is enough to make a difference for them? 3 months, 6 months? Or is that just going to make it hard for them when they do go back to 100% and have to pay?
That's the thing. We don't want to open a Pandora's box here. We want to make this something that's very helpful for those that are having an event, but not open a Pandora's box where we're spending time and energy taking appeals and becoming a welfare city program.
That's what the bishops are.
I mean, you're right. I mean, that's the tricky part. And I don't know yet if we have enough. I don't know if I have enough information to recommend 3 months, 6 months.
Okay.
I don't know. But six
I would
months
say
seems
not
a lot.
Longer than 6 months.
Six
yeah.
months seems like a long time.
6 months seems like a lot.
I
that's
think
a half
3 months
year.
is a boost if you can't afford gas for the, or if you can't afford utilities for the winter for this moment. 3 months is a boost, but I feel like 6 months would be a crutch.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
I think that's some good feedback then.
And I'm sure there's data out there that says people have an event, they don't get over it for how many months. I don't
right,
know that.
Right.
Yeah. The longevity.
True. And we don't know. I mean, we're not, that's not what we're in the business
no.
of.
Right.
Service we're in the business of providing. So, okay, I can
right.
do some more research then and see. I like I said, I didn't find any one policy that I thought, wow, this looks like this would work for us.
Yeah.
But it does open up a lot of additional questions thinking about preparing something that suits us best. So.
Let's go ahead and adjourn. Or
make a motion to adjourn.
Oh, second.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heidi.